Hi, you're listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters for the week ending Friday the 17th of October. We broadcast live on Triple R 102.7 from Melbourne, Wurundjeri Country, Australia. Coming up on this episode of the podcast, the best brat, Marie Cardi, comes in to chat about Better Off Said, taking place at Queenscliff Literary Festival, and Fee Wright reviews Solveig Buller's time loop novel On the Calculation of Volume 1.
For Tech Talk, Vanessa Toholka highlighted the importance to maintaining access to Australian radio in our new cars. And from Wildlife Victoria, Natasha Murray filled us in on the weird and wonderful echidna. And we chatted 4X, Pints and Ponies with comedian Alex Ward. Triple R. We are thrilled to be joined by writer, radio and TV Brat Bag and former host of Best of the Brat here at Triple R, like a cat with their disdain for water, the one and only Marie Cardi, who is putting on an event for the Queenscliff Literary Festival. Better Off Said, welcome Marie.
I think the only time Best of the Brat is mentioned in any introduction is when I'm here.
So dear to our hearts.
We claim you loud and proud.
As you should. I was here for like 20 years, yes. So I think it's fair enough. It was so nice to hear. Well, everything that Al Carlson song is amazing.
So
about Chappelle.
I know. She's
a goddess. I remember years ago, a Porto chicken in Bondi had a sign in their window. This is when it was all kicking off, and it said, "We support Chappelle Corby."
Yes.
They did it in marketing, but I don't know if that was just the Bondi a Porto going rogue.
It was just.
But I was like, they stayed on the chicken brand, but they wanted to
love
show
it.
That they support.
Porto renamed their sauces and the different, spicy.
Yeah, I feel like
lemon.
That would have been caught. And then to hear, well, I didn't know, were they pronounced Boom Crash Opera? I think they were Boom Crash Opera. Or was that
you.
Just
yeah.
like a quirk in the voiceover?
Might be a quirk.
Yeah.
We're a quirky crew
like,
here, aren't we?
Like, it's the Boomers.
Boom.
I bet they call the Boomers. And
boom,
I bet he
boom.
Hates it too.
Yeah.
The basketball team?
No, like the boomer generation. Don't you think that what's-his-face from Dale Ryder, how did I remember that, Boom Crash Opera, would hate being caught like, oh, it's the boomers. Oh. We're not boomers. We're cool.
Please.
We rock.
We've skipped that title.
We've covered about 8 different subjects.
I know we have.
Please too. My open tab brain is here to help.
And let's continue opening those tabs as well, because we've been talking about swimming a lot this show. Different sports. Not a fan.
You losers.
Losers.
No, I don't get in the murder wet if I can help it. But I do know a good swimming hole in Hepburn. It's a secret one. And
okay.
It's old as I announce it.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, I don't want you to get in trouble with the locals.
No, I'm not going to say where it is.
Good.
Because the locals are a murderous bunch when they're not interior decorating. They're out to kill. And it's sort of in the bush, and it used to be an actual swimming pool. So there are old photos of it around kind of with people in bloomers and kind of straw hats.
Interesting.
And so it's a muddy kind of leech-filled water.
Fantastic.
But at one side is like a concrete side with the swimming lane still written on it.
That's sick.
It's really good. I've skinny dipped in there and lived to tell the tale, so that's something.
I feel like a leech is kind of, I feel like you could get leeches in like a wellness retreat where they like clean your blood or something like
You're surprised they haven't made a comeback and monetized it yet.
I'm sure they have somewhere. I mean, the things
surely.
That people are like shelving and mainlining at the moment.
I know.
And I think for a particular generation, you hear the word leech and you just think of Stand By Me.
Of course.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, you're
it
there.
Goes straight away, the slow trembling hand picking up the big fat bloody leech off his genitals. Wow, good morning everybody.
Good morning all.
Best of the Brat is back on the air.
We love
Did
it.
Ever leave?
Organic. That's organic.
But how have you been? What have you been cooking up?
Oh, wow, God, that's a big question.
I know, isn't it?
No, life is really good. I'm really happy.
Mm.
I'm, you know, privileged to be a working writer, which I don't ever take for granted. And every writer's room I'm in, I always try and acknowledge that with the writers there, because I've worked in America. The American industry is cactus, as well as obviously the entire system and political system. But the Australian industry, the arts industry, is always on the ropes. It's harder to get things made. It's harder to get things greenlit. So I'm a working writer currently. AI has not taken my job so far, but I don't take that for granted either. So, you know, I'm cultivating an attitude of gratitude, if I may be so twee.
And you also, like, cultivate these amazing spaces where people can come together and it's a sharing of words and stories. You know, you've done your Women of Letters series and now
Better Off Said. Yeah, I've been doing that since 2019, which, of course, was a fabulous time to start a spoken word event. It was a good time because I ran the Melbourne Writers Festival for 2 years. And then I went, oh, I don't want to do that anymore. And then 2020 happened. So I lightly congratulated myself while thousands of people were dying. We started that in 2019. Emily Zoe Baker and I started this event in 2019. And it was at the Spiegel Tent in Collingwood, where Collingwood Yards is now. And it's all about saying things before it's too late, which I think becomes more and more of a pressing scenario the older you get, the more that the world seems so chaotic and brutal and awful. And how do you tell the people you love that you love them before it's too late? How do you say sorry and thank you and all those things? That kind of drove us. So the premise of the show is four writers speak to the provocation, the words I wish I'd said. And then every show we invite someone to give a living eulogy, so that we want them to eulogize someone or something that is still with us. So to give you an idea of the breadth of this, like, Benjamin Law eulogized Twitter at a show we did in Darwin many years ago. Stephanie Alexander eulogized eating as a family at the dinner table. Helen Garner eulogized being present in small moments. Jan Fran eulogized Scott Morrison's career. So it's not always. Tony Birch eulogized his sister, who is still alive. Yep. So sometimes it's a person, which also I think is beautiful. The idea of writing a eulogy for someone and giving it to someone while they're still alive is gorgeous. But we did a show a couple of weeks ago at the Brunswick Ballroom where we used to do monthly shows. Yep. But again, that's really tough, sustaining a monthly show.
That's a lot of work.
Well, no. I love the work.
Okay, yeah.
It's harder to get people to come to things.
Yeah.
In theatre, in live art, in live music. I mean, you would know we're in this industry. And it's money is tough for people, but the arts is really suffering in that regard. And we were finding we were barely making enough to pay our readers, and we don't always pay ourselves either. Obviously, we're not in it to get rich. The live arts spoken words.
What do you mean?
Ka-ching, ka-ching, baby.
Oh, damn.
So we did this show a couple of weeks ago at Brunswick Ballroom. We try and do two or three a year there. Sammy Shah did the living eulogy, and his was to a full night's sleep. Because he has small children, and how he used to fetishize sleep. And then when he was a teenager, he took it for granted. And he was actually just about to have another baby. We thought he might not be able to do the show, so I'm assuming that baby has now come.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes, thank you. I'll pass that on.
Yeah.
But Rachel Griffiths did that show, Sashi Pereira.
Amazing.
Now, a wonderful part of that show, Sarah Schwartz from the Jewish Council of Australia, who does incredible activist work and is really out there at the moment with a strong pro-Palestinian message, which is a very complex space for her to inhabit given her place in the Jewish community. And she wrote a really moving piece about feeling isolated from her friends and family and not knowing how to speak to them about what's happening in Gaza. And that piece was printed in The Guardian the next day. You can read it online. I think it's a really important piece to understand the complexity of the progressive Jewish experience.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of strength.
Yeah, she's incredible. To be in that room when she was saying it was, a real privilege and honour. But so I was really happy that piece got a wider audience and could go elsewhere. So, awesome. Yeah, Emily and I cultivate these spaces, and sometimes it's just for in that room, but sometimes, you know, it gets a wider range. And our hope is always that the person saying it gets some element of catharsis as well, that we're not just there to take from them.
Yeah.
But they too heal in some way. And Sarah said it was really important for her to say. She felt very supported and validated by the room. There was sort of a queue of people wanting to embrace her at the end, and she had a little bit of deer in the headlights look. But it was wonderful.
Oh, and beautiful. I imagine that the ripple effect would go far as well with everyone else who is in the room listening to these stories and what that would inspire for them, or how they would kind of integrate hearing other people share
own lives. Well, that's the intention, is that, you know, we're all walking around with this little bag of rocks that we carry, and when you hear someone, maybe you know them as a public figure, maybe you know them and they go, this is how I felt when my father died, or, you know, I'm uncomfortable in public spaces or whatever it is, and you go, oh, I feel like that sometimes, and that's where that thread of human empathy can find us, you know what I mean?
Yep.
So we curate these spaces because they're interesting and entertaining, but ultimately I think what I want the people on stage to take some healing from them, but people in the audience to go, God, we're all in this together. We're all white-knuckling it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No one knows what they're doing. Whatever you reach for in order to survive is absolutely palatable. Get in the water if you're a loser. Sorry, I'm a tree person, not a sea person. No, I have to take those digs.
Fair enough. And always such an important space and experience to share, but I would argue now more than ever, like in the age of AI and algorithms and like coming together, community and sharing and being in the room and that.
Yeah, being present
yeah.
and the humanity of that and hearing words from actual human mouth holes. Yeah, it's really integral stuff.
Amazing. Well, incredible. Where should people go if they want to attend to Better Off Said?
This is what we started before we started about talking about 8,000.
Yeah, I know.
Is that so?
We need Daniel Burt.
We are. We always need Daniel Burt. I love you, Dan, and I miss you. So we are doing a show Saturday the 25th of October at the Queenscliff Literary Festival. So every show is different because it's always a new lineup. Mm-hmm. So I try and curate them so there's a mix of everything. You put a comedian, a politician and stuff like that. One show we had, everyone went dark. One show we had, everyone went funny. But I'd say most shows are a beautiful mix of kind of light and darkness and sadness. So, but our lineup for Queenscliff is incredible. So we've got Hanny Rayson, the playwright, who's wonderful. Brian Nankervis, I don't know if you've ever heard of that
guy. An angel.
He's a living angel, isn't he? He must be celebrated at all costs. Shakufe Azar is doing it. Andrew Rule, the crime writer. Now, this is what I'm excited about. Okay. Our living eulogy is by Antoinette Latouf.
Amazing.
Awesome.
Now, I'm not sure what she's going to do, but when I talk to her, I'm like, I don't know. You could eulogize the ABC. You could eulogize journalism.
Just spitballing here.
I don't know, a fair workplace speaking out. So I don't know which way she's going to go. She could eulogize, I don't know, her dog who's still alive. I don't know.
Who
knows? But the joy is like putting someone. And we've always have a little bit of music at the end of the shows. And wonderful Sarah Carroll, who you'd also know, is going to play music.
Yes.
So that's on Saturday the 25th at Queenscliff Literary Festival, which has been so beautifully curated. And it's at 7:30. So we'd encourage people, because we tour a lot now, we do a lot of festival shows. We've been in Darwin and in Ubud and in Perth, and so we're in less.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to keep an
eye out. Snap up those tickets.
All over the socials, betteroffsaid.com.au.
Melbourne's own Triple R.
Yes. Fee Wright's here to talk books. Morning, Fee.
and not random Paddington insertions. I actually had a student say to me last week or the week before, Ms. Wright, you know, I'm really sad to be graduating, but I am really glad to not have to hear you talk about Paddington being the perfect example of the three-act structure anymore.
What?
And whilst offensive, it is the perfect example of the three-act structure. So,
it is.
Right on 30 minutes each. Anyway, I'm here to talk about books.
Are you sure?
Paddington.
Yeah, I do. Twist my arm on Paddington.
Paddington, the book.
Paddington, yes. Okay. So, no, I'm here to talk about on the calculation of volume. Volume 1 and Volume 2. It's a two-for-onesie today. These books are written by a Danish author, Solveig Barle. I actually looked up how to pronounce their name before I came on air, so I don't have another moment like I've had before. And I believe that's how you pronounce it. These books, there's actually going to be 7 volumes eventually. And the third volume is coming out next month, November 18. And so I thought this is a good chance to come in, talk about the previous two that have come out in English. There's 5 that have been published in Danish so far. So I was like, come in, talk about the first two, give you a chance to start to look at them before the next one comes out, because they are very, very interesting. Essentially, this is like a sort of Groundhog Day series. In fact, I actually read somewhere that someone called it Groundhog Day but written by Rachel Cusk, which was so good that I wished that I had have said it. I can't remember who actually said it. It wasn't me. That line is 100% accurate. So it is like a literary Groundhog Day if you will. So we meet Tara Selter on November 18. She's been on this work trip. She's a book antiquarian, and she's been to this big book sale. And then for some reason, she can't work out why, she gets like dislodged from November 18. So unlike Groundhog Day, where he wakes up in the same place and the, you know, the same alarm every day, she's kind of like displaced in time. So everyone else is living November 18, but she's living her own day within November 18, but no one can remember seeing her or experiencing her or doing anything with her previously. So it's like she's dislodged, or she's slipped out of time is the way that the back of the book describes it. And so time isn't really repeating for her. She can move about freely. She can travel. But it just remains November 18 no matter what. So she spends a lot of time in and I should say as well, these books are really short, but they pack a lot of punch. So each book's about 100 pages, not 100 words. That's a bit short. yeah, it's about 100 pages, give or take. So it's not enough time to get sick of it either, because it could get really repetitive potentially. But you see in the first book in particular, she's trying to unstick herself from this thing, you know, like it's like a movie. I'm going to try and, like, I don't know, did I buy a certain book that's an antique and did that upset things? Or, you know, so she's starting to think about things in like this sci-fi fantasy sense. And none of the things that she tries to do, which are all the things that you as a reader are thinking as well. It's like, oh, that book was dusty and weird. Maybe that's a magic book. But none of these things actually work for her, and she can't slip back in. She travels home to see her husband, and she keeps trying to convince people of what is happening. But as soon as they fall asleep, they forget everything she's told them, and then it starts all over again.
So they believe her in the moment?
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And so eventually with practice, she can work out how to get people convinced really quickly. But then she kind of reaches this, I guess, this sort of like existential angst where she decides that telling them and going through the effort, the emotional effort of explaining it again, is not worth it. So in the end, she actually at one point she moves into her spare room in her house and moves in such a way that her husband doesn't know she's there until she wants him to know that she's there. And so she'll, like, surprise him by coming home from the trip early, you know, and things like that. But then also she just kind of, like, slips into the, I don't know, the background of watching people go about their day. And she would continue to do this, except she realizes something, and that is that when she goes to the supermarket, there's less food on the shelves. Her favorite meals are running out and they're not being replenished. So she's out of time. The food that she's consuming is also out of time. And so then she realizes that if she continues to live with her husband in this way, she will, there'll be a food shortage, you know? So then she realizes that she needs to leave and move on and go somewhere else. And then that kind of becomes the second book. And in the second book, she decides that, well, look, all right, I've tried all these things. I'm going to get really depressed if I just keep doing this. I miss seasons. I've had a whole year of November 18s. I miss seasons. So she works out how to travel to springtime. She goes to summer in the south. She goes far north for the winter and the snow. And that's basically the second book of this experience of seasons and this meditation on time and seasons. And then the third book is out in about a month. So, yeah, so it's November 18, funnily enough, the next one comes out. And I have no idea where the book is going. I have a vague suspicion. I don't want to give anything away from the end of the second book, but I have a suspicion on where this book is going. But I also don't care, because I have read these two books twice, because I read them, ooh, first time I read them over Easter. I went away for Easter and I had them on my Kobo and I read them, which, sorry, that's just my little e-reader, my non-scary billionaire, gazillionaire e-reader. I read them on that, and then I reread them this weekend in preparation for this review, and I still really loved them. So at this point, I'm like, I am in.
You're in.
Yeah, I'm here for the all seven. It's very much, I feel like there's some Marcel Proust but approachable kind of energy. So Proust wrote a 7-volume book in Search of Lost Time or something like that. I don't know. The first sentence was like really long. I don't know. It's about a guy who eats Madeleine cookies and things about women. That's all you need to know. Mm. It's a big deal. But, that's all you need to
but
know.
But this is a bit of a literary phenomenon. On the calculation of volume, and then there are 7 books.
Yes.
Many of them have not yet been released, but the ones that have been released have won awards and gone hot.
Yes, so the first one, so the way it got on my radar was earlier this year, Volume 1 made it onto the list for the Booker. And so there's 5 that are out in Danish, 2 that are out in English, and so I believe there's 2 more that she's going to write in Danish, somehow wrapping it all up, and then we will gradually get them in English as well.
And do you reckon they're in the process of being written, or was there anything cynical about this?
No, I think that she wants. I think that the author, without actually having read any interviews, because I like to do that, I think that she wants us to read the book annually. And I think that she's deliberately staggering it to make you think about what's going on. Like, I feel like there would have been, I expected a little bit more like overt philosophy potentially within it, but it's much, much gentler than I expected. It's like, it's beautiful lyrical prose. I should also mention, I've noticed that there's different translators as well, which is also fascinating to me, because some people will only work with one translator. So the books that I've read so far have had the translation of work of Barbara Havland, but I read that the next one has a different, it has 2 translators.
Wow.
That are not Barbara Havland. So I'm like, what's going on, man? Mm. Like, there's so many different elements and layers. And I'm like, what if I don't like the third one? Is it because of the, it's because they got rid of Barb? Like, is Barb the piece for me? I don't know. We're on first name basis now.
That's cool though. That's like people doing their own reinterpretations of like ancient Greek or something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like the way that Emily Wilson translates ancient Greek as opposed to all the blokes.
Totally.
Yeah. I was like, she's the only one who's done it. She's the only woman who's done it in English. There's like a Richard Lattimore, whatever. Anyway, he simplifies everything. But these books are really fascinating. It's about 200 pages, and I thought giving everyone a month's notice would be enough time for people to potentially be able to have a look, pick them up, and, you know, get involved. In the book, sorry.
Sorry to be a basic bitch as well, but the front cover is pretty trippy.
They're all trippy. They're all really trippy, and there's 2 different editions, and I'm like, because I've got the e-books, I'm like, oh, do I want to? I'm going to wait till they're all bought. I'm going to wait till they're all out, and then I'm gonna get the pretty set, because I am basic.
And then you'll read them annually.
I read them annually. Yeah, but they're beautiful.
Mm. All right, on the calculation of volume, there's book 1, book 2, it's a series. And the name of the author again?
Solveig Boller.
Beautifully done. Fee Wright, thank you.
Thank you.
Triple R.
There we go. you're on Breakfasters, and we're very excited to nerd out here, or lift the bonnet. What's under the bonnet? Get into
the
tech world.
It was very apropos that you were talking about parking and car sort of things earlier this morning, because I did want to talk about car user interfaces. And it's an area that I remember when every car had a really simple interface to all the electronics. You know, there's some AM, FM radio, maybe a tape or a CD, and, you know, there are knobs for everything else. It's like you've got
I don't know, your hazards, it's a button, all yes. these sort of things. They're all like buttons and physical dials and sliders and for your air controls and all
tuning
this sort
it
of stuff.
In with the dial. That's like a romantic action.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then going through someone's CD case as well in the glove box. It's
love that.
Essential.
It's like a personality test.
It is, isn't yeah. it?
It's like I'm just planting this one here and it's just like, are you going to choose my yeah. fave?
Forget the Myers-Briggs test. Yeah. It's yeah, like yeah. you've got Barbie Summer Hits of 1992. Please pull over, I'm getting out.
Or around Christmas time, yeah. We had Smurfing Bells, which was like the whole Smurf Christmas like tape.
Lock the doors.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. It's like if someone chose that, you're just like, you are a happy person,
you,
my friend.
I like you.
And we must eject this after yeah. halfway through a song because that's as much of Smurfing Bells as you can hack. But look, fast forward to 2025. Every car maker has their own unique digital dashboards and they're often filled with, you know, what feel like quite complex menus, particularly because they're all different.
Mm.
And so what used to be maybe an action that you could activate with one button or one lever is now something you've got to find. What is the rationale mm-hmm. of how this menu is organized? How many menus deep will this function be? And very few people, I think, feel, you know, give you positive feedback about, are you happy with your user interface to all of your digital dashboard stuff? They're like, oh, I don't know, this could be better, or sometimes I can't find that, and this bit's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you jump in a rideshare, you're like, oh, let's put on Triple R, and they're like, I don't know how to.
Yeah.
I don't know how any of that stuff works.
Yes, I just have my radios sorted into the profile of my customer. I've had someone be very frank about that. Just like, I don't know, you're a woman of a certain age. I'm putting on Smooth FM. I'm yeah. like, oh, my Lord.
How dare you?
Yes. Yeah. I've never felt so unseen.
Pull over. I'm getting in the front and I'm going to program this in for you. Triple
four
R.
Stars. Only
yeah.
four.
Yeah.
You need Triple R for the fifth.
Yes.
Yeah. So look, that's a challenge. But it can also be a little bit buggy. Like compared to physical controls, which are often off and on or a spectrum, you know, you're trying to find things and you're like, there's a lag and you're trying to drive.
Mm.
There's a safety factor. But beyond all of this convenience, it's really interesting to think that access to radio through these interfaces has become more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And for some manufacturers, they've done deals with streaming services and what have you, and radio has been completely deprioritized. And we're seeing a few car makers experiment with no radio at all. So this
That's
is not
disaster.
Great for yeah. us. You know, we love radio. But beyond our you know, proclivities with Triple R and community radio in general, there's also a whole lot of safety factors which help create value around radio as a form of communication, particularly in Australia, this wide, you know, brown land.
Yep.
So what's been fascinating is that the CBAA, so the Community Broadcasting Association Australia, and the Commercial Radio and Audio Association, so they're like two opposite ends of the spectrum, and groups like ABC and SBS are all urging the government to bring in some legislative protections for access to radio to be kind of a universal requirement in Australian cars
in
and
car.
Vehicles.
Yes.
Yeah, which is fabulous. So what they're asking for is one button, prominent access to AM, FM, DAB+, you know, digital radio, and streaming radio built into every new vehicle dashboard. And they want to try and make sure that there's guaranteed discoverability and reliable verbal access
yep.
for licensed radio services on smart speakers, not buried under layers of mm-hmm. different voice commands, and legislative standards to require vehicle makers to ensure free and consistent access to radio, mirroring what have been historical protections already in place for other sorts of broadcasting,
mm-hmm.
like TV and radio.
Yes. So discoverability being like the key word here as well.
I think so, because when you think about the reason they want this universal access, a core part is about safety.
Mm.
Yes.
So when we have bushfire seasons, when we have cyclones, when we have emergency response, radio doesn't rely on power lines and wireless connections and all these sort of things. It's an older-fashioned kind of medium that has, you know, it's in the airwaves. Yes, you can get it digitally, fantastic, but you've also got layers of redundancy. There's reasons why, you know, military use radio. radio. And when you're travelling around, particularly that discoverability factor comes in because you're driving through regionals and you're going, well, what is the local radio station? How can I get news on which road I should be taking and what's the safest option and if traffic's being rerouted around a town or something? You know, so there are some really, you know, specific factors around safety.
You don't want to, if you're getting caught in a bushfire, which can happen quick, you don't want to be messing around trying to find the radio station.
And you need the weather reports, you know, you need local government reports, you need emergency services reports. Mm-hmm. And it's in these moments of, you know, emerging crises or, you know, just them being on the horizon that you kind of go, oh, wow, actually this is really important and my streaming service isn't going to give this to me. It doesn't know and care where I am particularly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And can I ask as well, like, aside from the safety element of it, is this kind of similar as well to like smart TVs and what we've seen as well with like default internet browsers where it's something that like people can monetize to put it as a default
in
their menu?
I think absolutely they can, yeah. So, you know, car makers are juggling the competing demands of what their users want.
Yeah.
And then where there's an extra opportunity to make a buck from partnering, say, with a streaming service, but also where they might find it cheaper to use software to access functions within the car rather than creating bespoke sort of toggles and knobs and everything and them varying throughout different models. You know, so you can see that there are cost efficiencies to have there, but then there are accessibility costs often with that choice. So it's really about a balancing act that they've got to navigate through. Funnily enough, you know, in 2014 we were on Byte talking a lot about car companies looking into different ways of digitising and how they're going to navigate that. And now we're seeing the trend almost hit a correction point where the car companies, so many of them, Volkswagen, Hyundai, Mercedes-Benz, Audi, Subaru and Porsche in recent times have all made announcements about bringing back physical controls to not everything but particularly to highly used features in the car and highly in response to customer feedback and evolving regulations.
Ah.
So different countries in the world are trying to go, here's what we think is the bare minimum that should be physical, or here's how you have to make this more accessible. We're not telling you how to solve the problem, just to improve it.
Mm. Yeah. I had a chat with Dr. Saul Griffiths, who's a very big electric vehicle and electric proponent, and he was saying, I love the idea of EVs, but I also just don't I don't want any of the – well, he was kind of saying that it's like $3,000 to $5,000 per car for all the new electronics. He's like, I don't want any of the new electronics. I just want the electric
vehicles.
It's
storage.
So true. And I think car companies are missing a trick if they don't hear this sort of wave of demand. I think we've gone through the, oh, it was shiny and new and exciting.
Yeah.
And now people are back to the, oh, I really just want it to work. And if anything ever has to be reliable and safe, it's in this context.
Yeah. I think the way he was putting it, he was like, I just want my old Land Cruiser to be electric with all the old buttons. That's all I need.
Well, there is an incredible local company doing exactly that sort of
really?
Thing. If you've ever heard of Jaunt Motors, they're electrifying. Their work is in, you know, custom electrifying cars that otherwise weren't available electrically. They even did Porsches for people. But, you know, Porsche have actually released an EV now. I mean, this is way out of the range of most of us, you know, mere mortals. But, you know, if I can get that in a Corolla, please, like this would be amazing.
Yeah.
And you probably can.
The never-ending sturdy Corolla.
Yes.
It goes and goes and goes.
It really does.
But yeah, it's when you're driving, you just want to be able to hit your radio button, turn up the volume.
Yeah, and you want to do it while you're keeping your eyes on the road.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Single button all the way.
Navigating the road, not the IT system.
Well, we wish all of the radio organisations a lot of luck in pushing this, and I hope everyone who drives vehicles keeps talking to their companies about the demand for, you know, physical touch interfaces.
There would be, like, contacts or emails and things we could send, I guess, like anything, do you reckon?
I don't know. Talk to your local, politician.
Yeah.
Talk. We're a community. Talk.
Make some noise.
Thanks all.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
It's
For Feature Creatures this week, helping us burrow into the latest echidna news and shenanigans, we're joined from Wildlife Victoria by ecologist and conservationist Natasha Murray. Welcome to Breakfasters.
Thank you for having me.
Now, tell us why echidnas particularly on your radar lately?
So at the moment, it's our busiest time of year because it's spring, so we're seeing loads more wildlife out and around us.
So that means you're getting more calls than ever right now?
Yeah, so last Wednesday was our busiest day in Wildlife Victoria history. We had 1,040 calls come through to our service.
Whoa.
Yeah, which is a huge number of calls. And basically, it's quite early in the year to be seeing that many calls come through in one day.
And so what's going on there?
So it's springtime at the moment, which means all of our native animals are kind of having babies at the moment. We've got nestlings from all our native birds. We've got ring-tailed possums, brush-tailed possums having babies, kangaroos having babies, and basically they're just everywhere at the moment.
Okay, so it was a majority of those calls were related to
always, road strike is a huge problem with our native animals, just because of increasing urbanization. It's getting harder and harder for wildlife to coexist in these spaces with us, and also harder for them to raise their young.
Okay, and echidnas are no exception?
Yeah, echidnas are no exception. They're not out as much yet as they will be in the coming couple of months, because in breeding time they tend to kind of do these echidna trains. They call them love trains. So you might see echidnas are normally on their own, and sometimes you might see multiple echidnas, which is basically the female will be kind of waddling along and a train of males will follow behind, and basically the last man standing is the winner.
So polite when they're doing it.
Yeah.
So it's just endurance.
Yeah, it's pretty much.
Just a big long walk.
A kid in a marathon. We're going hiking.
Yeah. You said you liked hiking on your profile.
Now, echidnas have really been around a while, huh?
Yeah. So they're actually one of the most ancient living subsets of mammals. So they're part of a family called monotremes, and monotremes are, they kind of diverged from the mammals that became us about over 100 million years ago. And there's two types of monotreme living in Australia. That's the platypus and the echidna. So we're very fortunate to have both of them here in Australia.
They can make their own milk and eggs.
Yes. So what makes them so strange as a monotreme is that although they're a mammal, they lay eggs, but they still produce milk. They're also kind of strange because they've got backwards facing feet, which helps them dig.
What?
They've got no teeth. and obviously they're covered in spines and can actually get themselves to a really low body temperature in harsh conditions, because they can enter a state called torpor, which basically shuts their whole body down. So if there's an event like a bushfire, they might burrow down into the ground and can lower their body temperature right down and kind of just survive by just...
Wow.
Using no energy.
Now, you've had a striking number of calls regarding echidnas.
Yes. So previously, we've not been too worried about echidnas. They're very resilient animals. They're very good at sensing vibrations from the road. So often when we see echidnas wandering, we kind of tell people not to worry, just kind of let them be on their way. They know where they're going. They have a great navigational system. And it's kind of better not to touch them because you're just going to stress them out. But literally from 2023 to 2024, we've actually had an increase of 230% of calls of echidnas actually needing help.
Wow.
That's to do with human-wildlife interactions. So pets are a big threat to echidnas. Like if a dog sees an echidna, they're kind of going to go for it. Echidnas are pretty hard.
And for the raw numbers as well, that's over 1,800.
Yeah, so just last year we've had 1,850 reports of echidnas, and it's only going to increase.
Now, do you handle the echidna? Do you get amongst it with the echidnas?
So I am a wildlife volunteer. I've actually not had the chance to rescue an echidna yet, but I used to work as an emergency response operator, so I've been on call to kind of guide through with a lot of volunteers about kind of how to navigate a rescue situation with an echidna. They're really difficult animals to rescue because their instinct is to burrow. They have really sharp claws, so if they're under any stress, they're just gonna get into the ground and grip on. And I've seen it take 4 to 5 rescuers to get an echidna like...
into the back of the van.
Yeah. And once it's in the van, that's a whole other problem because they can burrow through anything.
What?
So, like, metal, car doors, they'll... So if we ever have a member of public who's like, I've got an echidna in the back of my car, we're like, got to pull over and stop because he's going to... start
rip the joint up.
Yeah.
What's an ideal, like, habitat for an echidna? What so ideal conditions?
They are normally relying on understory vegetation and fallen logs because it gives them a nice place to kind of hide. They like to basically forage all day. They have little sticky tongues and they can just... basically, they don't get full, so they'll be eating.
God, they're odd, aren't
they? Yeah, strange little animals. But yeah, they would prefer to be in kind of woodland and bush areas. But as I said, they've adapted really well to kind of coming into suburban areas with us.
And they're quite solitary unless it's mating season and they're on a love train.
On a love train. I think the love train might have happened a couple of months ago.
Okay.
But now you'll be starting to see them come out and wandering because it's just their nature. They're actually Australia's most widespread mammal.
True. So,
yeah. They're just off on a walk. Yeah, it's amazing to see them.
But so they're survivors, but they need what, fallen logs or what helps them?
Yeah, so the understory and fallen logs is where they like to sleep because it's like anything with they can burrow into. It also helps protect them from extreme heat because they do have that low body temperature of about 33 degrees. They're very susceptible to getting heat stressed. So although they can kind of come up with these strategies to thermoregulate themselves in extreme events, that is kind of means going into that state of torpor I mentioned earlier. Whereas if we just want to have them kind of ambiently living and feeding, they need to have that understory vegetation to kind of cool them down and take shelter from the heat.
And what about pets? What's the elephant in the room, a cat?
A dog or a cat. So with any native animals, cats' saliva is actually toxic to native animals. So responsible pet ownership is a big thing with any of our native animals. Dogs and echidnas seem to have a bit of a strange relationship because dogs do not like echidnas. But the chances are that if your dog goes for an echidna, the echidna is going to hurt your dog more because he's got those spines. But then once he's become stressed, he's just going to stay there and he's not going to want to move, which obviously puts him under more threat because he's probably going to be in an exposed...
echidna's a sitting duck.
He's in an exposed spot. So it's just if you do see an echidna in your area, in your garden even, just keep your pets inside and the echidna will move on and avoid stress for both your pet and the echidna.
Can a spine grow back?
The spines, I think, can grow back because they do sometimes... we've seen in like bushfires and things, they get burnt, which is obviously painful for the echidna, but it is kind of a keratin substance. So eventually they will kind of can grow back.
How do you feel like the public perceives the echidna? Do you think that they love them or think they're cute?
I think lots of people think they're cute, but we also get a lot of nuisance calls. Like people kind of don't know what they're looking at. They're like, what is this thing doing in my yard? My dog's going crazy.
You need an eye test.
Yeah. But I think often in my job I'm trying to communicate how precious and important our native animals are. And echidnas are just such a wonderful example of... they're just the most bizarre little animals that have survived for millions of years. They're also looking after our ecosystem. They do really important nutrient cycling and aerating soil. And because they're everywhere, they're actually responsible for the health of countless ecosystems. So it's just appreciating how amazing and resilient these animals are. And we don't want to be the thing that kind of pushes them to the brink.
I guess, are they kind of like a native plough?
Yeah, a little bit. We normally would call them like an engineer of the soil. They're just kind of like digging things up.
Turning it over.
Yeah.
And what's road awareness? Is that a euphemism for God's sake, don't run over an echidna?
So road awareness at any time is if you know you're going past wildlife corridors, just drive slowly. Echidnas do cross roads. Obviously, they're quite small, so it can be hard to see. I know people in the past have put up signs in their communities to say that an echidna crosses here or there's an echidna living here. Yeah, it's just drive slower.
I guess lots of animals can be dawn and dusk, but I noticed a few echidnas out just in broad daylight
last week or two. Yeah, they're diurnal animals, so they'll be out during the day.
All hours.
Yeah.
It's like that when they have signs for the duck crossings, maybe we need a few for the echidnas.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've been talking echidna awareness with Natasha Murray from Wildlife Victoria. Good luck out there, and thanks heaps, Natasha.
Yeah, thank you. And if you ever see an injured animal, please just give us a call on 03 8400 7300.
Beautiful.
Triple R.
Comedian Alex Ward is in studio ahead of the return of her show for One Night Only. Clip clop, don't stop, but joins us for Let's Break the Seal on this Tuesday Rib Tickler segment. Hey. Morning, Alex.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Now, what's the... So this... When did you last do this show?
I last did the show in Melbourne during the Melbourne Comedy Festival, and if, you know, I just thought...
We're just checking to see if your mic's on here. Because the whole... If it's not,
take mine.
Just an example of one of the many gags I'll be doing on the night, live on the night. You never know what to expect from the stylings of Alex Ward. Sometimes it's on, sometimes it's off. You never know. So we'll just, you don't mind that I've taken your voice here, Nat?
Not at all.
Oh, this is quite cute. It's like we're backup singers in a band.
That's a joy.
Do you ever, when you look at backup singers, does that look like a fun gig to you?
Oh, it looks so fun. Oh, my gosh. Now I've got three mics.
Jace has sacrificed his own as well.
I think it looks fun. I don't mind. I'd be quite happily to take the back seat to be a back singer.
What about when they're dancing? The shimmying looks fun.
Yeah, it does. We can do this if you want to, Daniel.
Well, I've got no talent, so there's no... I mean, you know, I'm a notoriously incompetent shimmier.
My instinct then was to say, like, well, do you need to be a backup singer? But then I'm sure there's one listening that says...
You do. As someone who missed out on being in the chorus in a musical in high school, I auditioned and I didn't make the cut for the chorus, so...
And what, you were just like tree number three?
Yeah, I was a dancer. How demoralising. So anyway, got to be able to hold a tune.
We were just speaking off air about the Broncos and Brisbane kind of dominating sport. And then you drink 4X occasionally.
Yeah, occasionally. Yeah, not exclusively, but occasionally.
Because sometimes if I see a player celebrating with a 4X, I'm like, is that a contractual obligation? That's how deep my bias runs.
Okay, probably it is the sponsor beer. Like, you're not wrong to think there is a contract involved, but also it is just the most accessible beer. It is actually still one of the go-to beers in Brisbane. That's not far-fetched. I don't know if there's another beer down here that is as strongly linked to sport as the 4X is to...
Right.
To Brisbane sport. I'm thinking maybe, I mean, I don't know. What about Cup? As I said, I didn't grow up here. I've lived here 10 years now, so this is home. But is there any beer like that? Is Carlton Draft have that sort of chokehold on the sport scene?
Look, maybe. And it's, you know, you hesitate to say brands as well. But
I didn't want to start listing off the brands. But you brought up 4X, Vic. This was, no. So it's always been the big beer. And It's kind of good because I don't think you knew this, that it's a mid-strength. The big beer up in Queensland is a mid-strength.
And now your rationale for that is it's hot.
It's hot. You've got to drink it so fast. I mean...
That's quite responsible of them.
Yeah, I don't want to ruin any chances of me getting a massive sponsorship by 4X beer. But it is best enjoyed as cold as possible.
Yeah.
You want it to be at almost 0 degrees and onwards. So the moment it gets a little bit warm, it's not quite as drinkable.
Yeah. Well, I remember watching Wake in Fright and, you know, it's an iconic classic Australian film and they're in the outback and in a pub and everyone's drinking, what, ponies?
Yeah.
Because I guess it's so
pony,
hot.
Is that a pot or even smaller than a pot?
I think they looked tiny.
Yeah, I remember in a suburb of Brisbane, Fortitude Valley, where I was, I went to uni, I worked at a cafe near there. I used to go past this pub and every day there was an old mate there and he'd drink ponies. And I remember he could, like, he didn't drink them fast, but it also was just two mouthfuls was the pony,
right.
And that's how small it is. But, yeah, it is hot by the time you get to the bottom of that pony.
Okay, and that's why maybe they exist.
To really put things, like, because I think people forget how warm it is even in the southeast Queensland. Like, even in Brisbane 2 weeks ago, it was 35 degrees.
What?
Okay.
So, yeah, your beers are going to get warm.
You don't see pints much?
No.
For that reason?
No. You don't. if you're getting a pint, it's like, whoa, someone's on one. Like, yeah, okay. It's like, whoa, okay.
Are you okay? Mm.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, if
what's happening? Why are you trying to ruin your life?
Yeah, in Brisbane, if someone gets a pint, you call their family and friends. And you create an intervention.
Yeah, things are not going well.
But what about, you know, the Olympics coming? Are you do you think about Queensland and Brisbane a bit?
I think about it a lot, actually. Because I'd go back eventually, but now I'm thinking it probably won't happen.
Okay.
I don't long for it. Look, does that have anything to do with how expensive the houses are up there now? Maybe.
Right.
Does that have anything to do with you can't get a pint? Maybe. I do think about it a lot because I think, it's where I grow. I think people always do that.
But when it seeps into the consciousness so much, like, you can't help but think. It's like if you're overseas and Australia's in the news. It's like, ooh, you're paying more attention.
Yeah, I definitely am like, Melbourne's home until we won 3 of the major sporting events. And then I was like, yeah, I'll never not be a Brisbaneite. Like, those are my people. Yeah.
Get me home to those Broncos. Those baby Broncos and those ponies. No. Yeah.
Speaking of
sounds
beer.
Like a petting zoo.
Motley Bauhaus.
Yep.
This is where your show is.
This is where my show is. So you think you asked the top when my mic was very funnily muted. Good gag, guys. you also said the last time I did the show in Melbourne was. The last time I did the show, I did one performance since Melbourne Comedy Festival, but I thought, what if someone missed one of the million performances I did during Melbourne Comedy Festival? There might just be a small amount of people left that want to come see my show. That would, I mean, they had every opportunity in the world. But I'm hoping someone was, you know, busy and they still want to see it. So I thought I'd do it one more time. But also I am honestly doing this to feed the algorithm. I'm taping this one. So, yes, this is the cool. The belly of the beast. I'm leaning in. I'm just going to get some clips. You need clips. It's all about clips.
Clip, clop, you can't stop.
That's true. It's the perfect show title for it. Clip, clop, don't stop. I'm clipping up. So this is what's happening. I'm doing it at the Motley on Thursday 30th at 7:30. I've got Cez, who's a comedian, opening for me.
Awesome.
And I just want to do it one more time, and this be the last time, but then it's also on the internet forever. Mm-hmm. So it's a hard thing to promote.
The whole thing's going up.
I think I'm going to put the whole thing up.
Nice.
As they say, watch this space.
You should be telling people this because then is this disincentivizing them to come?
I think so, but a little bit, you're right. It is a terrible marketing angle of mine to be like, come, or watch it later. Oh,
I can't wait to sit at my laptop.
Yeah, watch it.
Watch my comedy.
Well, just know I plan on not colour grading it at all. So if you want to watch me in bright green, sure.
Just know that the sound will be peaking and the mic won't be on.
Sorry, I didn't say I was recording this well.
Yeah.
Is there any... When you obviously watch a lot of comedy, is there anything that's like that you want this to be? Is there any specific ideas that you have around what would work and what would work visually?
Well, I wanted it to be stress-free. That's quite hard, it turns out, when you because I'm self-producing, which I've never done on something as organised as this, I would say. I think mostly it's gone well. But yes, there is. I was very like, oh, I'm going to wait until I'm in a position where I can comfortably sell so many tickets, right? And then I watched Michelle Wolf's special on Netflix, and she had about 30 people in the room. Mm. And she's a very, very, I don't know if you know, very successful American comedian. And I was like, oh, I could just do that. Like, even if I'm not even sure, you know, this is another reason to come to the live
event. Was
she
the comedian
who
put an end to the White House correspondence dinner?
Oh, I don't know, maybe.
She was very good. Yeah.
But she was maybe the last one to ever do it.
That sounds like her. Mm. That sounds like her vibe. Anyway, I was like, okay, so to incentivize people to still come to the live one, I don't actually know where this is going to end up. I am recording it for a broadcast site standard, but I don't actually know where I'm going to sell it to you or if I even will sell it. Yeah. So I don't know what's happening. So
maybe
still have
you
to
might
come
just,
live.
Yeah, burn it to DVDs and sell it on the street.
Yeah.
But if you
I am going to Southeast Asia later this year. Cool. Maybe I will set up a little stall.
Now, here we go. Now we're coming up with some fun marketing angles.
Yes.
Why are you doing that? I mean, do you go there all the time?
To get the show out. Do you have a better way for me to get this film show out?
To get the bootleg circulating, to get a bit of hype.
If you have a better way to distribute this show, you message me.
Alex Ward is popping off.
CDs or DVDs, yeah. So that's something to look forward to.
What, the show? Or the,
no, well, it's
the holiday.
The bootleg copy. I have this. I have Paddington 3. That's about it.
What do you mean? You haven't seen Paddington? It's Paddington
3. No, I've got it. I've just got many a bootleg version.
Yeah,
big Paddington
right.
fan.
Are you?
I wasn't wrapped with the third one.
In Peru?
Yes.
No.
Look, oh, you agree
we could talk
me?
About this off air. I've got a lot of feelings about this. Some incredible cameos, but was it worth it to sacrifice the cost that went into the screenplay?
I've never said this out loud. I was really anticipating Paddington 3.
Oh, really?
I'm with you. I'm a big Paddington bear head. Mm. I love that. Have you seen these? They're so good.
No, I haven't. Oh. Fee Wright is a fan.
And there's
it famously knows what... Fee's talking about literature, right? So
yeah.
That's right.
She knows quality. Here we go. She's on the mic.
Best movies of all time.
Highest-ranked
films of all time, outranking Citizen Kane in the reviews.
seriously. What do you think about the third installment of Peru?
I heard negative things, so I haven't watched it, so that everything remains perfect in my brain.
Because
I don't want to. I don't want to sully.
Would you watch it if I could get you a copy that's worth?
I feel like
$600.
I feel like we could access that via various sailing of high seas and such. I'm just tentative. I'm tentative. The first two are so perfect.
Don't do it.
They are.
It's going to stay perfect in my brain. Anyway, I'm going to go finish writing my review.
Okay. Thanks, Fee. Yeah, there was a Geraldine Hickey remembers a joke from one of the Paddingtons, and it's stuck in my mind when she described it, and then when I saw it was when Paddington boards or alights, gets on an escalator, and the sign says must hold dog on escalator or whatever, and so he goes and gets a dog and holds one.
That's
how
Paddington.
How exciting. Clip, clop, don't stop. Where do we get to see you, Alex Ward?
Motley Bell House.
Yes.
In Carlton.
Mm-hmm.
Thursday the 30th of October, 7:30 p.m. It does say it ends at 9:30 on the website. That's probably a stretch. Don't stress out if you see that. It's probably more like 9. Yep. It's more like as I said, self-producing, I was like, how long does it take to get drapes down? Turns out the audience doesn't need to be there for that part.
No.
Unless they want to be.
Put the call sheet on the website.
And you can see the clips on your socials on Instagram. What do you know? A bit later. Okay, well, that's very exciting. Clip clop, don't stop on at Motley Bower House, Thursday, 30th of October. Good on you, Alex.
Please
for
come.
Here.
It will never make it online. I lie.
Triple R.
Thanks for listening to a podcast of the Best Bits of Breakfasters, the Monday to Friday breakfast show broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia. Feel free to get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or via the Triple R website.